as I stand before you, Shoftei Yisrael, judges of Israel, to lead the prosecution of Adolf Eichmann, I do not stand alone. With me in this place and at this hour stand 6 million accusers. But they cannot rise to their feet and point an accusing finger towards the man who sits in the glass dock and cry, "J'accuse." Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 215, A Trial Like No Other. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. The voice of the blood of your brother cries out to me from the ground. So God said to Cain after the murder of Abel. It is the Mishnah that gives us a famous teaching, noting that the Hebrew words, kol demei achicha, literally translated, means not the voice of the blood of your brother, but rather the voice of the bloods of your brother. The plural, say the rabbis, is a reference to the many potential descendants of the one that was murdered. For every life is an entire world. It was in one trial in the early 1960s in Jerusalem that a prosecutor would work to speak on behalf of so many worlds that had been ruthlessly destroyed. As a trial unfolded in Jerusalem, that would become one of the most important moments in the history of modern Israel. In 1960, Ben-Gurion created great surprise among the members of the Knesset when he announced to them that the Mossad had apprehended Adolf Eichmann, who had been hiding as Ricardo Clement in Argentina, and that Israel had succeeded in bringing him to the Holy Land to stand trial. Eichmann's evil actions were at the heart of the Holocaust. He had overseen Austrian Jewry's deportation in 1938. He then reported on the Einsatzgruppen murders in Europe to his superiors. He had organized and effectuated the Wannsee Conference, where what the Nazis called the final solution had been planned. And it was after Wannsee that the Nazis, seeking to murder Jews at an even higher amount, turned to the method of the gas chambers. Eichmann then oversaw the transportation of men, women, and children to the camps and engaged in constant efforts, even as the war was obviously going to be lost by Germany, to deport to the camps as many Hungarian Jews as possible. The story of the Mossad discovering Eichmann and taking him out of Argentina is itself an incredibly striking story, told in several different books, of how Eichmann's son came to his girlfriend's house and made a horrific comment about desiring the destruction of the Jews, utterly unaware that his girlfriend's father was of partial Jewish descent. The girlfriend, upon reading about Eichmann, went on her own to Eichmann's home to confirm his identity, and then her family sent the information to a man by the name of Fritz Bauer, a Jew who had grown up in Germany and who then chose to go back to Germany after the war to work as a prosecutor. This prosecutor then informed Isser Harel, the legendary head of the Mossad, and then an operation began that would ultimately come to a close with the capture of Eichmann near his home on Garibaldi Street on the outskirts of Buenos Aires. With Eichmann having been brought to trial, the question that faced the legal officials in the Jewish state was who would preside over it and who would prosecute the case. According to Israeli law, it seemed that because the trial would take place in Jerusalem, the choice of judge would lie with Binyamin Halevi, who was the chief district judge in the city. Halevi, it would seem, would then go on to appoint himself to preside over the trial. The problem, however, was that Halevi had earlier presided over a very controversial libel suit regarding accusations against Rudolf Israel Kastner, who had negotiated with the Nazis in Hungary. Because of these complications, the Knesset passed a law making an exception to the procedure of judicial appointment in capital cases, knowing that the trial of Eichmann would be the first capital case in Israel's history. The scholar Michal Shakey tells us of the solution proposed by the president of Israel's Supreme Court, Yitzhak Olshan. Quote, Olshan suggested a solution, an amendment to the court's law stipulating that in trials for crimes punishable by death under the jurisdiction of a district court, the presiding judge should be a Supreme Court justice and should be appointed by the chief justice, at the time Olshan himself. Consequently, the president of the district court, then Halevi, would appoint the panel's two other judges. His colleagues in the government accepted Olshan's proposal, and the law was amended. End quote. In the end, an Israeli Supreme Court Justice, Moshe Landau, was asked to preside, along with Halevi and Yitzhak Raveh. Landau had grown up in Germany and spoke German fluently, a factor that would feature at certain points during the trial. But how should the trial be conducted? Here, real tensions would feature throughout between Justice Landau and the man that would prosecute the case. The presiding judge sought for the trial to be like that held in Nuremberg, focusing specifically on Eichmann's crimes. And of course, there were so many crimes on which to focus, from the deportation of Austria's Jews to the absolute horror that was Eichmann's actions in Hungary. Historian Deborah Lipstadt writes, quote, "In the space of 2 months, with portions of Hungary on the verge of being liberated by the Soviets, Eichmann organized the dispatch of 437,000 Hungarian Jews to Auschwitz-Birkenau. Approximately 75% of them, about 330,000, were gassed. The fate of Eichmann's deportees gave Auschwitz its legendary status in the annals of genocide. The crematoria, despite having been designed to burn multiple bodies simultaneously, could not handle the load. Fire pits were used to supplement the ovens. The smoke from them was so intense that it was visible in the reconnaissance pictures taken by American planes." End quote. Judge Landau, therefore, wanted to focus on the crimes in the manner that the International Tribunal at Nuremberg had focused on the crimes of the Nazis. But the prosecutor, a lawyer with a different background than Justice Landau, a man that, of course, wanted to focus on Eichmann's crimes, also wanted to include another element in the trial. Gideon Hausner had worked as an attorney, but not in the judiciary. He had served as a politician and a corporate lawyer. When he realized that he would have to appoint a prosecutor in the most important trial in Israeli history, he chose to prosecute himself. But he understood that this was not a classic criminal case. He was attorney general of a country in which there were many citizens that had survived the Holocaust. He was attorney general of a country where the effects of Eichmann and his evil comrades were everywhere. In the fascinating documentary, The Adolf Eichmann Trial, there is a story described by Gabriel Bach, who was part of the prosecutorial team that oversaw Bureau 6, which investigated and compiled evidence of the Holocaust throughout Europe. Bach describes that he had reached out to the Polish government asking for documents pertaining to the Shoah, but had received almost no help in response from the government itself. Yet, he says, there were those that sent documents anonymously to Israel. They therefore received papers with numbers of Auschwitz prisoners, along with the dates that corresponded to the arrival of each of the prisoners given these numbers. Bach therefore said to the members of Bureau 6 that in order to utilize these documents that were anonymously received in the trial, they had to be verified. He therefore suggested that for verification, they would find Israelis that had tattooed numbers on their arms who could also remember when they had come to Auschwitz. The numbers could then be matched to the documents and the dates, and thereby the papers would be verified. As he spoke, one of the police officers in the room rolled up his sleeve, and on his arm were numbers. He announced the date that he came to Auschwitz, and it matched precisely to the document. This man, Michael or Mickey Goldman, would play a fascinating role in the story of the trial and what followed, a role that we will describe in future episodes. But his own story is one example highlighting how this was not a regular trial. As Michal Shaked reflected, Gideon Hausner took a different approach than Justice Landau. Quote, "In his eyes, the trial was an all-embracing epic, which all of Israel and the entire world were supposed to watch and hear," end quote. And what this means is that while Gideon Hausner could have focused only on the evidence of the role played by Eichmann in the Holocaust, and of course, much of the prosecution did focus on that, Hausner also chose for the trial to give a voice to the victims and to allow the survivors to tell the judges, the audience in the room, and all of Israel how they had suffered and what they saw happening to their families. This was an element that would make the Eichmann trial very, very different than the Nuremberg tribunals. Thus, Hausner stood at the beginning of the trial in Jerusalem, at the building known as the Beit Am, the people's house, and he referenced God's words to Cain. Hausner said, quote, "As I stand before you, Shoftei Yisrael, judges of Israel, to lead the prosecution of Adolf Eichmann, I do not stand alone. With me in this place and at this hour stand 6 million accusers. But they cannot rise to their feet and point an accusing finger towards the man who sits in the glass dock and cry, J'accuse, for their ashes were piled up in the hills of Auschwitz and in the fields of Treblinka, or washed away by the rivers of Poland. Their graves are scattered over the length and breadth of Europe. Their blood cries out, but their voices are not heard. Therefore, it falls to me to be their spokesman and to unfold in their name the awesome indictment." End quote. A prosecutor speaks in the name of the blood or the bloods of Jewish generations. It was a sign that a trial in Jerusalem was about to unfold that would be truly unlike any other. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow, signing off.